This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham.
You've heard about this trial going on in federal court in Richmond. Former governor of Virginia and his wife facing numerous counts of alleged corruption. Correct me if I'm off target, but does it seem like the defense strategy is our clients didn't break any laws, it's just that the former first lady had a crush on this really rich guy. Anybody see that coming? This is a Politics Update edition of Insight, so there's lots to discuss in addition to the McDonald case. Pipeline politics, for example, with environmentalists up in arms over bids to build new natural gas lines through several counties in our region. The U.S. Senate race, Congress on break, and what was left undone before they left. Medicaid, immigration, policy toward Israel. In fact, just about anything political you'd like to bring up, our Politics Update team will be on hand to respond right after the news.
Great to be with you. I'm Tom Graham, and this is Virginia Insight. Politics, our focus today. We are coming to you from the studios of the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities, but our phone number, the same as always, 888-WMRA-TALK. Already on the phone line with us, McClatchy News Service White House correspondent Anita Kumar. Here in studio, Bob Gibson, executive director of the Sorensen Institute for Political Leadership. Plus, Jeff Skelly, associate editor of the Sabato's Crystal Ball Political Newsletter. Welcome all.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us on.
Great to join you.
Well, anything political is fair game this hour from the rather, can I say, unusual trial of a former Virginia governor and his wife to foreign policy concerns across the globe. First up, an issue that we are going to be discussing at greater length on the next edition of Virginia Insight this coming Monday, but since public meetings on it have already started, we'd like to give you a few minutes of analysis, courtesy of the publisher of The Recorder, the newspaper of record for Highland and Bath counties, Ann Adams. Thank you for making time for us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Well, Ms. Adams, the issue is pipelines, specifically a new interstate natural gas pipeline that would run through a good portion of Virginia. What can you tell us about it?
So Dominion is considering this natural gas pipeline to carry gas from the Marcellus Shale in West Virginia all the way to North Carolina. And the pipeline would be about 550 miles. Dominion has not, by the way, made its final decision to do this project, but it would cross all of Highland County.
And it would go Highland County, Augusta County, Nelson County, and then south towards North Carolina.
Correct. And with a spur toward the Hampton Roads area.
And there are some environmental groups who are not pleased with this idea.
Plenty of them. They are objecting primarily to the idea that this pipeline would cross both the Monongahela National Forest in West Virginia and the George Washington in Virginia.
Now, there was another company that was proposing a possibility of a different pipeline. These proposals are coming as a result of a request from Duke Energy in North Carolina, which says it wants to transfer from coal-fired plants to natural gas and it needs greater supplies of natural gas. And one of the companies responding to the Duke suggestion for proposals was this company called Spectra Energy, and it wanted to bring a pipeline south from Pennsylvania through parts of Virginia into North Carolina, and it would have gone in our listening area through Culpeper County, Madison County, I think Orange and Louisa, and then further south. But as you, I think, were the first to report yesterday, Spectra seems to have backed off.
Indeed. They tell us that they are suspending any effort on that pipeline. But they have also indicated they may work with Dominion on this pipeline that Dominion has proposed. But they're not sharing any details, so that's all we know.
So Ann Adams, publisher of the Recorder newspaper in Highland County, it was just a couple of days ago that Dominion held the first at least three public presentations that it says it's making in front of county boards of supervisors. As I understand it, these really can't be called public hearings because Dominion is saying it at this time is not going to take questions from the public at these meetings, only from boards of supervisors. But the first one was before the Highland County Board of Supervisors. You were there. What happened?
It was a very good turnout, including some guests from Augusta and Nelson and North Carolina, in fact. So it was a full courtroom for us. They Dominion's Chet Wade, who is the VP of Communications, gave an introductory piece on Dominion and what it does and how the company is set up. They also included an engineer and a land acquisition person and an environmental person in the audience to help answer some of the questions from our board.
And what kind of questions were asked? What kind of answers were given?
There weren't a lot. They limited the time, but they asked primarily, our board is concerned about emergency services. These crews of 10 to 12 surveyors or workers will come in at a time, and they're on very, very rugged terrain here, and complete with bears and snakes and, you know, what have you. They and our rescue squad is sorely hurting for volunteers. And so their concern was, if one of your fellows gets hurt, we might not be able to respond to them. And can you help negotiate with us a way to beef up our rescue squad and fire department to help, you know, get more people on the ground for it in case of emergencies? And their response was, we'll talk about it.
And have you heard, this is Bob Gibson, have you heard concerns from property owners along the route of either pipeline that Virginia law currently allows pipeline folks to go on property owners' property without their permission, and there is going to be some sort of effort in the Virginia General Assembly upcoming to tighten that up?
Yes, they're very concerned about that. The law does give these utilities the right to come onto your property and survey and build, ultimately, through eminent domain if need be. Dominion tells us that 95% of the time it doesn't get to that point. But these survey letters went to landowners requesting permission, and the landowners needed to reply in writing within 15 days whether or not they would allow the surveyors on their land. At this point, Dominion tells us they will not send surveyors onto land where people have declined to allow them. But they will continue to negotiate with them and, you know, use whatever means under the law they need to eventually.
Do you think that Spectra's decision that you discovered yesterday to pull back from the Orange-Madison-Culpeper-Louisa pipeline route might be temporary and they might really throw in with Dominion and go ahead on plans later?
It's possible. They're really not disclosing much, and it sounds like this decision has just been made very recently.
We, Ann Adams, did receive an email from a Spectra spokesperson this morning because we had contacted them about the full-hour show that we're doing on this issue, the various pipeline proposals this coming Monday. And I was struck that the Spectra spokesperson was very careful to say, we've suspended it for now. We're looking at other options. We'll be in touch when we make further decisions. So it doesn't sound like they're closing the door here by any means.
I don't think so.
Ann Adams is publisher of the Highland County-based newspaper, The Recorder, and attended the first of a series of public meetings about the proposed Dominion Natural Gas Interstate Pipeline Project. Next week, public meetings on that issue scheduled in Augusta and Nelson counties. And on Monday, on the next edition of Virginia Insight, we'll be devoting the full hour to further analysis of this topic. But for now, Ann Adams, thank you so very much for spending a few minutes with us this afternoon.
Thank you. We'll see you Monday.
Now, Bob Gibson, Jeff Skelly, and Anita Kumar, I'm wondering if any of you just might have thoughts about Virginia's most recent former governor and first lady, Bob and Maureen McDonnell.
Generally speaking, it's
you're all just being really polite. That's what
yeah,
it was.
Yeah.
It wasn't that you didn't have thoughts.
Yeah,
What to say?
Yeah, I mean, really, actually, what do you say?
I've heard the term "throw under the bus" more times in the last week than I'd heard in the previous 2 years.
Yeah, it's been at this point. The fact that this is going to last for 5 weeks is it's basically like someone did a mini series soap opera.
Jeff Skelly, it's hard to believe, from at least the perspective of those of us who've been following this trial so closely, that there could be many people listening who know nothing about this. But it's possible. It's also possible that there are people who don't know very much about it. So give us the basics.
Well, essentially, this company called Star Scientific, their CEO, a man named Johnny Williams, became very close with the McDonald's, the former governor, and his wife, along with the family, and essentially provided them with money and various other gifts, such as a Rolex watch that said Virginia governor on the back of it to the governor. Mrs. McDonald went on various shopping trips in New York City. There essentially very large sums of money were thrown out. Johnny Williams, I think, paid for the catering at Bob McDonald's daughter's wedding. And none of this was reported. And in Virginia, if a gift is over $50, you are supposed to report it. Now, there
aren't $50 to the official holding office.
Right, not the family
members. Yes, next to family doesn't matter. But Bob McDonald did receive some gifts that went unreported. And Johnny Williams also gave money to their real estate operation. The McDonald's had, like many people, had bought real estate at perhaps the worst possible time in 2008 and were some fiscal trouble as a result of that. And Johnny Williams had given them – I think they claimed it was a loan, but I don't know if that was really true or not. A lot of this went unreported.
In the neighborhood of $50,000?
There was a $20,000 loan that the governor had asked for in a text message and that Williams had agreed to provide. There was a $50,000 loan prior to that. So there were substantial loans. They have been repaid, but it's not clear when they weren't reported whether they would be repaid.
Okay, but you haven't even actually hit on the part that none of those things are illegal unless they didn't report it correctly. I mean, the what they're accused of doing is using the office of the governor to help Johnny Williams and his company in return for getting those items.
Yeah,
that's
the famous
quid pro quo. Right.
That's where you break the law because Virginia's laws are so.
Very lax.
Okay, I'm glad you said it.
Very, very lax.
Yeah, not much in terms of regulation about what public officials can receive, let alone what their family members can receive, even though there's been a little tightening of the law earlier this year, passed through the General Assembly. You're nodding your head, and it looks like
small tweak.
I mean,
yeah,
it's
very, very little.
Very small tweak. But, and now the words intangible and tangible matter, and most gifts under the new rules would actually qualify as intangible and therefore would not have any limits under the new rules, so... It's really questionable how much that did.
But Anita Kumar with the McClatchy News Service, as a former political reporter in Virginia, do I understand correctly that what may have gotten Bob McDonald and his wife Maureen in trouble is the idea that all these monies and favors that they were taking from Johnny Williams could have been in return for government action prompted by the governor, and that's a violation of federal law?
That's right. I mean, the way to look at it is, and I'm not saying there weren't some reporting issues. There definitely sounds like there were. But just the big picture here is they can accept those things that they did. And, yes, they were a lot of gifts and loans and things like that. The loan's kind of unusual. But some of those things have been taken by, not the loans, but gifts have been taken by previous governors. It's not illegal to take them. And it's actually not illegal to help Virginia businesses, as Bob McDonald did. What is illegal is if they can prove that he helped the business or tried to help the business, actually, in return for the gifts. That's what the law is.
And we haven't even gotten to the explanation of the term thrown under the bus or soap opera. So we probably need to spend a little bit more time on this, but we got lots of other political updating to do as well. Our analysis panel, White House correspondent for the McClatchy News Service, Anita Kumar. From the University of Virginia's Center for Politics, Jeff Skelly. And the leader of the Sorensen Institute, Bob Gibson, will be with us when we get back in a bit more than 1 minute. Expensive dresses, Rolex watches, tantrums in the mansion, and a supposed first lady crush on a rich guy. To you who are listening, have you been following much of the McDonald trial going on in federal court in Richmond? If yes, what do you make of it? Has it altered your opinion of Virginia's once extremely popular former governor? If no, how have you managed to avoid all those headlines about the court case? On Facebook, it's WMRA's Virginia Insight. Bob Gibson, I think it was you who first used, in this hour, the term thrown under the bus.
It's an interesting legal strategy. Giftgate, as the entire affair has been sort of termed since February when the Washington Post broke the story in a front page fashion that's been front page many times since February, took a strange turn last Monday when the trial started, and the defense made it clear that its strategy was to allow Maureen McDonald to be the fall person who basically did lots of things at Johnny Williams' request, the businessman's request, and took lots of gifts for her, she not being a public official, and that her marriage with Governor McDonald had basically fallen apart by that time, and she had a crush on Johnny Williams, according to the defense, and was pursuing him in ways that included asking for lots of expensive gifts, trying to promote his product around the country in various forms and forums, and making him her favorite playmate, as she was once called it. So there is a great deal of skepticism among a lot of people that perhaps the defense is making a great deal out of the governor's wife because she was not a public official.
And so if she's taking many tens of thousands of dollars worth of gifts and loans from a rich guy who wants something from her husband, and she's doing it just because she has a crush on the guy, she's not breaking any laws.
But she is charged with conspiracy, and conspiracy involves working with her husband to promote the product in ways that the product clearly in some ways was promoted. There was a first mansion rollout of the product at which state officials were sort of summoned as if it were an official gathering. There were entreaties made to researchers at the University of Virginia and Virginia Commonwealth University, MCV, to handle the requests that Johnny Williams was making to have some money put into this product in terms of research and studies.
The product called Antiblock.
Antiblock.
A derivative of tobacco.
Right, which
supposedly
has some value, according to one Maryland researcher who testified this morning, that a rodent trial showed that it might have some therapeutic value regarding thyroid conditions.
Anita Kumar, you were in Richmond covering Virginia politics for The Washington Post for much of the period that's being discussed now in this trial when Bob McDonald was governor for 4 years. What has struck you about what's been coming out and coming up in the testimony?
Oh, so many things. I guess a couple things. I mean, one thing that Bob just talked about is how they're talking about how the McDonald's were sort of estranged or not getting along, or she was a sad and sort of lonely housewife. They actually, in public, were very they looked very friendly together. They were, they always sat together and, he was not in any weird way, just, they were holding hands and they were very affectionate in public. So that sort of struck me. I mean, that's how they always were. And I think some testimony came out yesterday that Bob McDonald had written her sort of a poem or a love letter or something during the time that they're talking about. So there's some dispute whether they were really not getting along. I guess the other thing that just sort of struck me is that is not sort of who Bob McDonald portrayed himself as, material items and things like that. I mean, he's very much, if you ever talk to him, he'll talk to you talk your ear off about the history of Virginia and the history of the office that he held. I mean, he just never really talked about those other things, those other perks that, you know, that they're talking about, that they enjoy the vacations and the gifts. That's not who he portrayed himself as.
In terms of what is supposed to be or supposedly being portrayed from the witness chair as revelations about what was really going on in the governor's mansion. I mean, the former chief of staff for the First Lady, Maureen McDonnell, saying yesterday that she was, to put it kindly, a terrible boss, that she was constantly throwing tantrums, that sometimes she would be screaming so loud at her staff that security would come running in to see if somebody had been hurt. Did that kind of stuff surprise you, or had you been hearing that kind of scuttlebutt while you were?
Yeah, that didn't surprise me at all, actually. That had been talked about for some time. We had heard, but we were never given, when I was there in Richmond, access to emails where we heard that staff at the mansion had written to the governor's staff complaining about her and how difficult she was to work with. I mean, a lot of people had talked about that over the years, and so that didn't really surprise me. She was very, the First Lady, as First Lady, was very particular, and I'm not sure I knew that she enjoyed materialistic things as much as coming out, but she very much did. The portrayal about that she liked those things didn't surprise me nearly as much. And there was, you know, turnover at the mansion. There was definitely something there.
Anita, I have a question for you. Were you surprised that there were 1,200 text messages exchanged between Johnny Williams, the businessman who provided all these loans and gifts, and Maureen McDonnell? And what do those 1,200 text messages, emails, and phone calls indicate?
Yeah, it's been really interesting seeing that because, you know, we don't know what they say. They could just be silly little, you know, questions, and a text message could be a yes, a no, you know, a smiley face. It could really be anything. But 1,200 is a lot. But I think, I can't remember the number that they've indicated, but they show Johnny Williams, gosh, they had how many text messages he'd had in a year or a few months, and it was enormous. It was a large amount. So clearly he liked to communicate that way with a lot of other people. You know, it's interesting, the text messages are one of those things that, we'll see what the technology experts say, but some of those text messages are in dispute. I mean, Johnny Williams says, I didn't receive them or I didn't make them. You know, we also don't really know. I mean, maybe she was making more text messages. She was sending more texts than he was sending back. So it is a lot. But when you think about sort of how much we text back and forth with just little tiny responses, you know, you got to think of it that way.
My daughters do. I don't.
Bob Gibson is executive director of the Sorensen Institute for Political Leadership. Anita Kumar serves as White House correspondent for the McClatchy News Service. Jeffrey Skelly is associate editor of the Sabato's Crystal Ball political newsletter. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. We've got call-in lines open at 888-WMRA-TALK. Or if you prefer to type instead of talk, you can reach us on Facebook, where we are listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. And we have this from Nancy on our Facebook page. She says, my concern is with the product that Johnny Williams was peddling and why the McDonald's would help promote a product of such doubtful value and potentially harmful. Was Antiblock investigated? I have heard little about this except that it was a diet supplement.
Well, a diet supplement does not have to get FDA approval. So there had not been lots of clinical research trials proving the medicinal or dietary value of this product. It can be sold on the open market as a dietary supplement without that kind of scrutiny. But Johnny Williams was trying to present checks to Virginia officials and other gifts to promote the research that he thought would add to the sales of his product. And 14 University of Virginia people, including researchers and administrators, were subpoenaed to testify. All 14 won't make the stand, probably, but that's a large number of UVA folks who basically have, at least the one doctor who testified on Tuesday, said so far, we didn't do anything. We took the money. We were surprised to get it, and we decided not to investigate this product.
Yeah, essentially, Johnny Williams was probably looking for this as, you know, a legitimizing force for his product. the more research that's done on it, if any of it shows there to be any benefit whatsoever to his product, means more money for him, which kind of goes back into the quid pro quo. I mean, he was clearly looking for some tangible financial benefit from his relationship with the governor and his wife.
Well, as always here on Virginia Insight, we are willing to circle around and go backwards at any point in time. We're going to move on to some other topics now, but if you feel at some point that you want to get back to something we've already discussed, that's fine. Phone number is easy to remember as 888-WMRA-TALK. But let's move on now. Anita, I think this is probably from you. This is on our Facebook page from Carolyn, who says, the Obama administration has green-lighted a plan to allow the oil industry to search for possible oil and gas under Atlantic waters using air guns and sonic blasts that environmentalists say can harm marine life. And what if they find oil and gas? Obama was president during the BP Gulf oil crisis, yet is willing to let this happen in the Atlantic Ocean. I voted for him because I thought he'd protect the environment, but now I'm wondering if it really matters who's in the Oval Office. Are all presidents under the control of big oil? End quote.
Well, I think that what we saw from the president was that after the oil spill, he did sort of back off. He stopped. I actually was in Virginia and Richmond at the time, and I remember how Governor McDonnell was so happy that they were going to allow some drilling, and then those things stopped after the oil spill, and that was due to President Obama saying we need to take another look. They are slowly going back the other way. I think it's important to note that this is still testing. I do know that environmentalists have some concerns about it, but we are not yet at the point of full-on drilling for oil and gas. So.
Well, the oil and gas exploration has been supported by Virginia officials of both political parties. Both U.S. senators, governors, all down the line have said, basically, let's find out what's out there and let's see if it can be safely and profitably exploited and whether there's anything worth exploiting.
But is it true to say that the president has not been terribly friendly to the Keystone oil pipeline project?
Oh, he has held that up for some time for study after study, and the State Department has finally issued its report, and still nothing has happened on that.
Right.
Yeah, which would seem to suggest that he's not under the thumb of big oil, because if he were, he would probably have already okayed that, given all the public pressure and the fact that a lot of polling would suggest that a majority of Americans support doing the Keystone pipeline. They may not really know what that entails, but the polling would suggest that they do support it. And yet he has it okayed it.
Anita Kumar, some other news cropping up there in Washington today, one having to do with the Veterans Administration and some legislation the president signed earlier today.
Right. He actually came to Virginia just over the line at Fort Belvoir to sign a bill that actually Congress passed a bill before they left. They passed a few, but this is probably one of the most significant bills they passed this year. And this is after the scandal this spring about the Veterans Veterans Affairs Department, where veterans were saying that their wait times were very long, they couldn't get appointments, and then the administration, or rather people at the hospitals and clinics, covered the long waits up. This is responding to that. It's a $16 billion compromise between the House and the Senate that basically will include money for new doctors and nurses. It will allow people to get private care if they live more than 40 miles from a VA facility, so in a lot of rural areas, and it will also open 27 new medical facilities. So again, the president signed it. He went to the Fort Belvoir to sign it and talk about the changes that he's made over there. They're also changing some things over at the VA at the administration level. Obviously, there's a new secretary, and they're putting in a lot of new top management over there.
The other big issue, of course, as Congress was heading out of town, was immigration reform, and there seemed to be some action on the House side. The Senate's already passed a compromise bill that hasn't gone anywhere in the House, but the House, up to the last hours, was looking at a dwindling-sized measure to provide some relief for these children, handling these children coming over the border from Mexico and farther south. What happened in the House, and was it really... A Republican rebellion that cut the speaker's legs off?
Yeah, I mean, I guess they passed something, but, they're not. It's not going to get passed in the Senate. And the Senate did the same thing. They passed a bill that's not going to pass in the House. So, here we sit. So now the president has, you know, Congress has left, for those that don't know, for 5 weeks. It's their annual summer recess during August, so they won't be back until early September. The president has said, he said yesterday, actually, that he's going to have to, he can't wait. Part of what he wanted was money to sort of help with the border situation, unaccompanied minors coming over the southern border through Texas. But he also wanted some changes. They're stuck on this, and so he's said that he's going to have to, he can act on his own in ways that he can find to act on his own without congressional approval. He'll announce some changes by the end of the summer. So there's been a lot of talk about how he's going to, what changes he might make and how significant they'll be. And of course, you know, the House Republicans will not, they will not be happy with that. They're already, you know, they're already wanting to sue him, or they're already suing him over changes he made on the health care law. So we're going to see, the president's actually getting ready to go on vacation on Saturday. So nothing probably will happen for a few more weeks.
Anita, as you mentioned a few moments ago, $16 billion more a year for Veterans Affairs, so more money for more doctors and other health care specialists for veterans. But does this new legislation do anything about the fact that apparently managers throughout the apparatus were lying about how long veterans had to wait to get health care?
Yeah, this actually, the bill includes new powers for the secretary that basically whistleblowers who brought the problems to their attention shouldn't be penalized in any way. And it's important to note, I think just last week that the VA announced that they had fired some more people, or they were planning to fire two supervisors and discipline four other employees in Colorado and Wyoming accused of falsifying health care data. So, I mean, I think they claim that they are going to take a really hard look at managers who allowed things like that to go on, and the bill will give them more power to do that. But, I mean, the president said today at the bill signing, we've got to follow through. Just because you have the power now doesn't mean it's over. You've got to keep following through on this, or the issue's not going to be resolved.
Jeff Skelly from the University of Virginia Center for Politics, skipping to yet another topic that has both Virginia and national connections, same-sex marriage. What can you tell us about what's been happening in the court cases there?
I know that in Virginia we recently had two cases that undid the ban on same-sex marriage in the state of Virginia. And this just is kind of the latest domino in a number of, well, the latest domino in a set of cases around the country in many states that have undone bans on same-sex marriage. And it makes you wonder, you know, in the end, are these going to be appealed to the Supreme Court? And will the Supreme Court end up actually legalizing gay marriage nationally by undoing every same-sex marriage statute or anti-same-sex marriage statute in the country?
Bob Gibson, Virginia's Attorney General, is trying to get it to the Supreme Court.
He is. He's taken action this week to try to expedite the Supreme Court review. And so far, the courts have been rather unanimous in their findings that the states cannot ban same-sex marriage. So I think this is a fast-track issue. I think Virginia is the second state. There's a Midwest state, perhaps Oklahoma, that went first to get this to the Supreme Court. And I think we will see another major ruling from the Supreme Court, probably upholding the same ruling that went 5-4 last year.
Politics Watchers Bob Gibson, Anita Kumar, Jeff Skelly with us on this edition of Virginia Insight. We've got a couple more posts to look at on some other issues that have just cropped up on our Facebook page. We'll be back in a bit more than 1 minute. Our analysis panel on this edition of Virginia Insight, White House correspondent for the McClatchy News Service, Anita Kumar, from the University of Virginia Center for Politics, Jeff Skelly, as well as the leader of the Sorensen Institute for Political Leadership, Bob Gibson. My name, by the way, is Tom Graham. And on Facebook, we've got this from Jennifer, who asks, oh, this is nice and simple. Whatever happened to Medicaid expansion? Any ideas, Bob Gibson?
Well, in Virginia, not much has happened. It was the issue that tied up the General Assembly until the Senate switched party control from Democratic to Republican with Phil Puckett's resignation. And since then, very little has happened. There is a session set for the 18th and 19th of September. in which the General Assembly is not expected to solve the issue at all. So I think Governor McDonnell, although he made this a high priority to expand Medicaid and get more benefits back to Virginians that are going in tax dollars to Washington and going now to other states, will not have anything to point to in his first year in office that expands Medicaid. But he's got a four-year term, and issues change. So perhaps after his first year, this will be an issue that is more seriously looked at for compromise. There's been no compromise so far.
I guess this exemplifies why Democrats in Richmond were so determined to make Medicaid expansion a part of the budget. Republicans were saying, oh, well, let's just bring it up separately. And this is exactly why Democrats didn't want to do that, is because they knew that it would just end up going nowhere. And that's what you're seeing now. Once the Senate fell into Republican hands after Phil Puckett resigned, that made the issue more or less dead letter, at least for that budget cycle.
I believe there's a new poll out from Gallup just today taking a look at different states that have or have not expanded Medicaid. And if I'm recalling correctly, I don't have the exact numbers in front of me, but for all of the states near Virginia that did choose to expand their Medicaid coverage under the Affordable Care Act, the number of uninsured people in their state has gone down significantly. In Virginia, it's gone up by a tad.
Well, states like Kentucky have set up their own exchange and done it very well. Other states like Maryland haven't fared so well with Medicaid expansion. But the numbers of uninsured folks are coming down in those states, whereas in Virginia it's relatively a static number, over 400,000.
I know supporters of the Affordable Care Act, just kind of the larger issue that Medicaid expansion is tied in with, point to Gallup figures that have that show that the number of uninsured in the country, number of people who respond to say that they are still uninsured, has dropped a few points since the act came into effect. And so that would, I guess, lend some credibility to their argument about it at least insuring people. The other issues, the expense and whatnot, are still obviously out there.
Well, to you listening in, Congress is on break. Senators and representatives, for the most part, back in their home states, traveling around, holding public hearings and town hall meetings. Have you seen any such thing going on in your neck of the woods? Got any opinions on what Congress did or did not do before starting its August recess? You can post to us on the Virginia Insight Facebook page. I was going to poll next, looking at you, Jeff, and I mixed up page and poll and tried to combine the two, and it didn't work very well. But let's get to more polling. We've got three open congressional seats. And one of the things that you do at the Center for Politics is track congressional races all across the country. Of the three open seats in Virginia, where members of Congress have either been knocked out by primary, which is Eric Cantor's case, or retired, the case of two other members of Congress, is there anything competitive there, or are they going to stay with the same party that's already holding them?
Well, at the moment, the only open seat race and the only race in Virginia that looks particularly competitive in the congressional side of things is the Virginia 10th, which is a district that stretches roughly from Winchester into western Fairfax County. And that was a seat that's been held by Frank Wolf for about three decades, and he is hanging up his congressional spurs.
Republican.
Yeah, Republican, member of the House. And the at the moment, we rate that race leans Republican, which is to say that it is the Republicans are slightly favored there. Toss-up would be the next rating over, the only more competitive rating we'd have. And that just kind of illustrates that district. Mitt Romney actually won it 50-49 at the presidential level in 2012. And so the district slightly favors Republicans, and Republicans have nominated Barbara Comstock, who's a state delegate, who has an impressive fundraiser. She actually raised about $1.5 million for a state House race, like House of Delegates race, which is an unbelievably large amount of money for a House of Delegates race in Virginia last cycle.
And she's from northern Fairfax County?
Yeah, she's from Fairfax County.
And her Democratic opponent is also from Fairfax.
Yes, and her Democratic opponent is a member of the Board of Supervisors in that county. His name's John Faust. He's raised a fair amount of money already, and partially through self-funding, but he should be able to make that relatively competitive. At the end of the day, though, the midterm atmosphere is likely going to favor Republicans more than Democrats for a few reasons. First, historically, the out-of-power party in the White House usually does better in midterm elections. Turnout in the last midterm and other recent midterms would suggest that the people who are going to show up to vote are going to be more likely to vote Republican, an older, whiter electorate, which in our current political setup means more Republican-leaning voters. And so for those reasons, and in a district that slightly went to Romney in 2012, those are kind of the reasons why we have it leans Republican. And besides that, the Virginia 2nd down in the Tidewater, we have likely Republican, but that is probably going to remain the same, and basically there's no other competitive races in the House.
Virginia has a system of gerrymandering that's quite effective, and the 11 congressional seats in the House of Representatives have all been made stronger for the party that controls them. The Democrats and the Republicans have traded voters. The Republican congressmen have given Democratic-leaning areas to Democratic congressmen nearby and vice versa, so that the Republican districts, all eight of them, are slightly more Republican. And the Democratic districts, all three of them, are slightly more Democratic.
Yeah, exemplifying this, actually, Frank Wolf's district under the old lines in 2008, Obama actually won it 53-46. But under the new lines, Romney in 2012 won it 50-49. And under the new lines, but with the 2008 figures, Obama would have slightly won it. So you can see and similarly next door, the Virginia 11th, which is held by Democrat Jerry Connolly, that district got a few more points Democratic, just kind of illustrating your point.
This is Virginia Insight. Here with me at the studios of the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities, Jeff Skelly, who you just heard speaking. He's from the University of Virginia Center for Politics, plus head of the Sorensen Institute, Bob Gibson, and with us by phone, political journalist and McClatchy News Service White House correspondent Anita Kumar. I'm Tom Graham. Here on Facebook, we have this from Susan, who's in essence saying, any word on what elected officials are saying about the possible pipeline projects? This is something that we've been discussing early in the hour. And Susan, as far as we know, no elected officials have taken a stand on the proposed Dominion pipeline that we were looking at earlier in the hour. We're going to look at this a bit more in depth on Monday. But probably, Bob Gibson, the reason that nobody's taken a stand yet is because it's still in flux.
It's very much in flux. The routes aren't set yet. One route was sort of pulled back a little bit yesterday, the one that goes through Madison and Orange and Culpeper and Louisa. There was some public reaction to that, and the folks at Montpelier, the presidential home of James Madison, were up in arms because basically the route would have taken that pipeline through Montpelier's old-growth forest, and that would have damaged, they said, the area that is pristine and really a part of the presidential estate that, that people want to protect. So there was citizen reaction there. I know in Augusta County and in Nelson County there's been significant citizen opposition, and the elected public officials are taking the temperature and paying attention to that, I'm sure.
Anita, I know you don't cover Virginia politics anymore, but we got this great question from Heidi that I just want to invite you to chip in your response to, should you feel so moved.
Okay.
Heidi's saying on Facebook here, is there any hope for getting marijuana legalized in Virginia anytime soon? Is the answer voting for more libertarians and putting them in office, or is there another strategy that might get major party politicians on board?
I don't see it happening. Not in that General Assembly. I mean, I guess the answer is always, you know, if you want that to pass, you vote in different people. But I don't see that happening. There have been bills that have been brought up. I think that was that are... I mean, how many years did that come up? That came up for a number of years. I don't know if it's still coming up in the General Assembly, but they never go anywhere, and people sort of mock, some of the legislators sort of mock those bills about marijuana. I don't see that happening.
A Republican delegate from Matthews County brought it up before he retired, a pharmacist, and got one vote for his bill to legalize.
Every year, though, he brought it up for a few years, didn't he?
Yes, and it's It's not going anywhere anytime soon.
I don't know if since he left, if anyone's nice man. I don't know if anyone's bringing it up now.
I think one of the Arlington delegates has looked at taxing marijuana sales, but we don't have any marijuana sales we can tax yet.
Well, Heidi, thanks for that question. Let's go back to some national and international politics with you, Anita. Also in Washington today, some talk about what to do in northern Iraq as a possible humanitarian intervention by the U.S.?
Yeah, there are tens of thousands of religious minorities in Iraq that are basically on a mountaintop, sort of separated, dying or ill from heat and thirst. They don't have food or water. And there's a question about how to help them. And so some administration officials are saying that the president's considering airstrikes or airdrops of food and medicine to help them. But I had just before this interview come from the regular daily White House briefing where the press secretary, Josh Earnest, would not confirm that the president was even considering that as an option at all. But that's what we're hearing, is that they are considering that.
Skipping to another national, international issue, the president's remarks last Friday summed up with the quote, "We tortured some folks."
Yeah, he said it in kind of an interesting way, didn't he? There was a lot of people saying, why did he talk that way about that? So basically, the administration has been working on a 6,300-page report that talks about the interrogation tactics used after the 9/11 attacks. There's a 500-page executive summary, quite a long one there, that's going to be released to the public. And the administration and some lawmakers on Capitol Hill are disagreeing on how to release that. It's up to the Senate Intelligence Committee. They have the power to release that. But they are not releasing it because they say that the administration, the CIA, and intelligence officials have redacted too many things, and it's not an accurate portrayal to the public. So there's a bit of a dispute back and forth. I mean, it's interesting to note that the chairperson is a Democrat. Many of the people that are complaining are Democrats. So this is definitely not a partisan issue. This is an issue of what the public should be told about what's happened and what the government did after 9/11. So where things are right now are the committee says they're not going to release the report. Mark Warner's on that committee, actually. The committee is not going to release that report, and they're asking the administration to take another look at some of these redactions.
Anita, didn't the CIA send over a drone or tap a phone or two to find out what the Senate Intelligence Committee was doing?
Well, they improperly, I'm trying to remember exactly how that was phrased, they improperly went into some of the computers. Yes, the CIA spied on the Senate Intelligence Committee. It sort of admit that it improperly looked into their computers, and they have since apologized to that. But that sure doesn't help things, this back and forth between the committee and the administration. A lot of people, some people, I should say, are questioning John Brennan, who's the director of the CIA. Should he resign? Should he be fired? The president said that he fully supports him and that John Brennan has apologized for what happened, and that's good enough.
Jeff Skelly from the Center for Politics at the University of Virginia. Anita Kumar from McClatchy News Service mentioned a few moments ago the senior senator from Virginia, Mark Warner, who's in a race for re-election this year. You're tracking polling. What does it look like?
Well, currently Warner has a fairly sizable lead in the polls. The most recent poll average I saw had him up 53-34.
Against
Ed Gillespie, who's a former chair of the Republican National Committee, was an aide to President George W. Bush. But Gillespie, I think people probably shouldn't write this race off because Virginia is very competitive politically. In fact, in the last two elections, it's presidential elections, I should say, it's been the state that has tracked closest to the national result. So at the moment, Virginia really is kind of the bellwether state. And so that would suggest that Gillespie's probably going to do a bit better than 34%. It's just kind of a question of, what is the national atmosphere, national environment going to do? As I said earlier, it's not particularly great for Democrats, but is it going to get worse for them? And a lot of that, I think, depends on the president's approval rating, because Mark Warner, in this day and age, this very polarized era, can probably only run so far ahead of where the president is at, since he's very easy to connect to the president.
Anita Kumar, we're almost out of time, so keeping with tradition, last question to you. The first Senate debate happened recently in West Virginia. You got 10 seconds worth of thoughts about that?
Oh, well, people couldn't watch it on TV. Doesn't sound like there was a whole lot of news. They two of them had some back and forth about birth control. How's that for sure?
I was sure you were going to say how unthrilled you were that the first Senate debate for two Virginia candidates was held in West Virginia.
I will say that. I believe the two have not actually agreed on another debate. And I understand it's tradition. I will say, get on my high horse about this, that the Virginia Bar Association hosts the first debate. I've attended many and reported on them. But they often do their event at the Homestead, which is in Bath County. But this time it happened to be at the Greenbrier, which is in West Virginia. And I'm just not sure that the Virginia Senate debate should occur in another state. But clearly,
our guests have been Bob Gibson, Executive Director of the Sorensen Institute for Political Leadership, Jeff Skelly, Associate Editor of Sabato's Crystal Ball Newsletter, as well as McClatchy Newspaper's White House Correspondent and Charlottesville native Anita Kumar. Thank you all so much. Thank you for tuning in for this edition. I'm Tom Graham. Hope we can get together again soon for more insight.
Thank you.